somebody had to man the high-technology instruments of war, and those who were merely computer fodder had to be protected against their knowledge. They could not be trusted. Patriotism, especially during the Vietnam era, was a waning motivation. Their memories had to be erased. But, he explained, mind control was not needed to make a killer. Professionals didn't usually need to be motivated. Most members of search and destroy or executive action, unquote, teams were already willing to kill men, women, or children if their superiors ordered it. I concluded that he meant a career killer didn't need to be debriefed by mind control. When I said that, he contradicted me. You want to bet, he said? They'd all kill, but they might not be able to keep the secret. It would depend entirely upon what activities they were involved in, whether the assignment was combat, mop-up, search and destroy, political assassination, or whatever. This debriefing is done in such a way, in many cases, as to cause actual memory damage. As things have gone along and progressed, the techniques have been smoothed out, but memory damage still occurs. In certain cases, memory recall is so critical that they bend over backwards to be damn sure that you can't remember. Many of the things that occur are not as pretty as you'd like the public to think, he said. So you've witnessed many atrocities of war, I asked. I don't call them atrocities, he countered. I call them military actions. There's a lot of conflict of interest there, the politicians against the military. The next section here, Bauer induces the assassin to talk about political assassinations in this country and also the distribution of power. And interestingly, he confirms that JFK, RFK, Martin Luther King were assassinated by lone nuts. He says that George Wallace, who was shot by Arthur Bremer, was the work of a true kook. This goes to show, I guess, that assassins are dealt with on a need-to-know basis, because certainly there's massive evidence indicating that George Wallace, who was removed from the 1972 presidential race by Arthur Bremer, was indeed removed for political reasons, and that Arthur Bremer was anything but a lone nut. This is material we've covered before, not only on One Step Beyond, but on Hard Rain as well. Then the patriotic assassin, as Bauer calls him, goes on to talk about how he says basically the CIA is just a figurehead, and that it's the National Security Agency, the NSA, that runs the hit teams and who really is the heavy in this country, I guess you might say. Certainly that's his assertion here. Continuing here with Bauert's account. I let him rail a while about the evils of the government and then brought him back to my main point of interest. Okay, who killed JFK, RFK, King, and who is behind Bremer, I asked. He didn't remember who Bremer was, so I explained that he was the man who'd shot Wallace. Oh, yeah, he said. Bremer was just a kook. Wallace was shot by just a kook. But whoever got the Kennedys and King probably got a medal. We were set up to wipe Castro out. Kennedy interfered at the last minute. You want to take a guess at who killed him? Oswald was just a patsy. I've fired the same kind of rifle Oswald was supposed to have used. You can't rapid fire that thing like he was supposed to have done. Now, who do you suppose killed Kennedy? Don't kid yourself. This country is controlled by the Pentagon. All the major decisions in this country are made by the military, from my observations on the clandestine side of things. The CIA is just the whipping boy. NSA, the National Security Agency, are the ones who have the hit teams. Look into their records. You won't find a thing. Look into their budget. You can't. For the life of you, you can't find any way they could spend the kind of money they've got on the number of people who are supposed to be on their payroll. Even if they had immense research and development programs, they just couldn't spend that kind of money. The CIA is just a figurehead. They are more worldwide, like the FBI is. They're accountants, lawyers, file clerks, schoolboys. They are information gatherers. They've pulled a lot of goddamn shenanigans, I'm not going to deny that, but as far as intelligence goes, the NSA is far, far superior to them. Far in advance in the black arts, unquote. The CIA gets blamed for what NSA does. NSA is far more vicious and far more accomplished in their operations. The American people are kept in ignorance about this. They should be, too. In other words, I responded, what you're saying is that the military is more dangerous to our democracy than the CIA or other intelligence groups. The CIA gathers information, but the military heads the show. Look at how many former military officers work for the CIA. Look at how many former high-ranking military officers work for the multinational corporations. Can't you figure it out? Well, next, the patriotic assassin goes on to say basically that there are about 18 or 20 people who run the whole United States, and goes on to talk about many U.S. intelligence agents who continue to work for corporations, and primarily corporations, while at the same time working within our own government. Continuing here with Bauert's account. What are you suggesting, that there is an invisible coup d'etat which has occurred in the United States? I asked. Okay. There is a group of about 18 or 20 people running this country. They have not been elected. The elected people are only figureheads for these guys who have a lot more power than even the President of the United States. You mean that the President is powerless, I asked? Not exactly powerless. He has the power to make decisions on what is presented to him. The intelligence agencies tell him only what they want to tell him, however. They don't tell him any more than they have to or want to. You have to wonder at American stupidity. How much does it take to get people to wake up to what has happened? It's public knowledge that the CIA has falsified documents and given presidents fake intelligence reports so that he can only arrive at one conclusion, the conclusion that they want him to arrive at. The Pentagon Papers revealed that fact. What people don't know is that global corporations have their own version of the CIA. Interrupting here, this recently has become certainly much better known than it had been in the past. An excellent book on this subject that we've referred to in the past on this and other programs is called Spooks by Jim Hogan. And if any of you would like to get further information about that, you can ask me during the phone-in section of the show. Continuing here with the Patriotic Assassin's account. What people don't know is that the global corporations have their own version of the CIA. Where they don't interface with the CIA, they have their own organizations, all CIA trained. They also have double agents inside CIA and other intelligence organizations who are loyal to those corporations. I mean, where's the bread buttered? Would you rather take the government pensions, or would you rather work a little for the corporation on the side and get both government pensions and corporate benefits after you retire? Most men retire after 20 years, and they're only in their mid-40s. Then they go to work for the corporation they've been working for while they were in government service. They get both the pension and the corporate paycheck that way. Together with what the corporations do on their own, they have a worldwide espionage system far better than the CIA's. There is a network of what amounts to double agents. They do work for the government and may appear to be government agents, but they are first loyal to the corporations. They report to those corporations on the government and on what foreign governments might be planning which would interfere with those corporations' foreign investments. These guys are strictly free enterprise agents. And the next section here, Bauert discusses with the Patriotic Assassin some of these agents, these free enterprise agents, as the assassin calls them, and apparently the assassin maintains that these agents spy on the U.S. government and that secrets get out all over the world this way. It's certainly interesting to speculate about what effect, if this is in fact the case, what effect this, what implications this has, I should say, for Ronald Reagan's sort of high-tech security pitch that has absorbed, basically has occupied so much news space, so much space in the newspapers recently. Continuing with Bauert's account. You call these guys contract agents, I wondered? Oh, no, no, no. Take, for example, we develop a new death ray. We've got all the security the government can think of on it. We've got the best security in the United States on it, which is tied for second place for the best security in the world. Tied for first place are the Russian and Chinese security systems. Now, even with all this security on a government contract, that death ray is up for grabs in every nation in the world. Any amount of military security can't keep it secret. What you're saying, I interrupted, is that American people are selling secrets wholesale to the highest bidder. That is to say, I assume if the highest bidder is an American company. And even if it's not, he said, usually it is another nation. I've dealt with weapons, and usually the nation that wants it most will pay the most for it. Once in a while, these companies, these government contractors, will find that someone has stolen one of their secrets, and there'll be a big flap. But the big boys that are in the military are an entirely different ball of wax. The big guys get away with it. When one of these companies finds someone inside it that's selling secrets, they take him on a fishing trip, a boat ride, and get rid of him. It's quite common, he said. For example, if I was tied in with one of these companies where money is no object, and they wanted me to get rid of you, I'd obtain a passport or a duplicate passport with your smile and face on it. After I'd obtained it, I'd put whoever's face on it I wanted. Then, after we dumped you, that someone, unquote, whose face was on your passport would take a trip to Australia. Later, your friends or family would notice you were missing, and people would begin to inquire as to your whereabouts. Eventually, they'd check with Australian customs, who'd say, yes, this guy entered the country on such and such a date. By then, the guy who traveled over there on your passport would already have come back on his own, and as far as the best detective could tell, you've gone to Australia, and you've never come back. Next, the assassin gets into the actual discussion of mind control, and he describes various techniques which are used for mind control. And interestingly enough, he takes up the whole question about whether or not mind control research has stopped. And the government has often maintained that, yes, they were doing research on mind control, but that it stopped. And what the assassin confirms here is that, yes, the research has stopped simply because no more research is needed. The techniques are all operational and have been for some time. Continuing here with the patriotic assassin. What do you know about the military or the intelligence agency's use of pain drug hypnosis, I asked. They used several different things. I've seen, actually seen, guys coming back with blanks only in certain places of their memory. Let's say that I know positively, not by hearsay, that it's done. You've seen it, I asked. You'll never get me to admit it, he grinned. Well, how is it done, I asked. They use hypnosis and hypnotic drugs. They also use electronic manipulation of the brain. They use ultrasonics, which will boil the brain. When they use hypnosis, they'll at the same time be using a set of earphones which repeat, "You do not know this or that," over and over. They turn on the sonics at the same time, and the electrical patterns which give you memory are scrambled. You can't hear the ultrasonics, and you can't feel it, unless they leave it on. Then it boils your gray matter. Unless the assassin had done the same research I had, he could only have known this through first-hand experience. The CIA documents released in 1976 revealed that ultrasonic research was undertaken for a period of more than 20 years. But the documents said that the research had stopped, so I asked him about that. Yeah, the research has stopped. They've gone operational. It ain't research anymore. They know how to do it, he said. Do you mean that it is your opinion that it hasn't stopped? Or do you mean that you know it hasn't stopped, I asked. I mean I know it hasn't stopped, he said. For example, suppose that a dictator in some South American country is setting up real problems and we try to kick him out. We call in some of my former group and say, look, the bastard has got to have a fatal accident and it's got to look good, like he fell on a bar of soap and broke his neck in the bathtub or something. So we go down there and get the job done. But it could be quite embarrassing if any of the guys were cross-examined about where they'd been and what they'd done. So the guys who were in on the job suddenly have a cold or something, and they are put in a hospital for maybe just a routine checkup. They come out of the hospital in about 15 days. They're alive, they're well, they're healthy, and they're happy too. Lots of luck if you question them. They don't remember anything. Next, the assassin goes on to talk about how mind control is also used to improve the memory of couriers. He continues here. That's one way it's used. The other way is to use it to improve memory, say with couriers. You want a secret message carried outside the chain of command. There's no need to have it carried by a person if it's a legal message, because the military's got 1,000 ways of sending messages which are unbreakably secret. But if it's outside the chain of command, as so many things are these days, if it's an illegal message, and our Constitution doesn't permit us to do much that is legal, then you have a hypno-programmed guy carry the message. You improve his memory so that he can carry an entire coded book of what appears to be gibberish. And when he's got it down, you give him amnesia and seal off that message by a post-hypnotic code word and whammo. You've got a real good secret courier because he can be tortured to death, but he can't remember. Unless the proper cue is uttered. Then if the courier is going to operate against the enemy, who might have the techniques of hypnosis down, you give him several layers of post-hypnotic command. In the first layer, he'll confess a false message. In the second layer, he'll confess another different false message. Finally, maybe on the fourth or fifth layer is the real message. Now, our guy who is supposed to get the message knows that the first three cues say are fake. And he gives the fourth cue, and out comes the correct message. If the courier was in enemy hands, he could be there for years before anybody will figure out where he was in all those layers. Each identity will probably be that of a real cutout, unquote, a person enough like him so that the enemy will think that they've got the real guy. Many of the men in my unit were given assignments after which they were so persuaded, unquote, that they didn't remember anything. I mean to say they'd gone in believing that the only thing in life that meant anything to them was completing the assignment, to get it done. And when they got it done, and when they got done with it, they couldn't remember anything about it. Could those guys have been that way without hypnosis, I asked? Well, they could have believed that their mission in life was that particular assignment. They usually had no family affiliations, no friends, nothing but their careers. But I don't think they'd have forgotten about those kind of assignments. Not without a little help, let's say. What was the conditioning that these guys had? Was it drugs, hypnosis, or something else, I wanted to know? Hypnosis, electrotherapy, programming them by tapes, by voiceover earphones, awake or in trance or asleep, by a number of methods. How widespread was this mind control, I asked. Well, that's something I can't really answer. I know of several different groups upon whom it was used. I know that it was used in some of the hairier areas of Korea and Vietnam, and it was started in World War II, but it's been refined far more since then. How much of it was used, I don't know. I know of several groups that I was affiliated with that had it used on them. Would you say this kind of thing did not exist before World War II, I asked? Oh, it did, but it was not in such a sophisticated form. It's as old as man, but now it's refined to an art. Before, it was torture and psychological pressure. That can accomplish a lot. We've been trained to use it in primitive field situations. But now it's done. Now it's done with the idea that the mind can be put on. But now it's done with the idea that the mind can be put under complete control. Just like they used to use rubber hoses at the police stations. They don't do that anymore. Well, rubber hoses still work, but they don't work as well as some of the other things which the police now have. The next section here, the patriotic assassin maintains that the police, in fact, have mind control. And he goes on to describe the kind of work he was doing for the military. And apparently, one of the things he was doing in the military was engaged in assassinating people developing technologies that could potentially be threatening to the United States, even if these were countries friendly to the United States. So he goes on here. Are you saying that the police use mind control, I asked? At the highest levels, yes. The FBI certainly uses it, and they, of course, give a lot of help to the local police. There are certain areas of the brain which control your inhibitions. When they control those centers, then the subject will go on with his assignment regardless. I've seen men whose mother could be sitting there having coffee, and if they'd been instructed to kill her, they'd walk right in and shoot her, and it wouldn't even upset their appetites for supper. They were conditioned to do it in such a way that they have no guilt. They wouldn't have guilt because after they were through, they wouldn't even remember it. Let me tell you something. The cheapest commodity in the world is human beings. Most assassins don't need to be programmed to kill. They're loyal to command. They're conditioned, first by the circumstances of their own early life, then by a little loyalty training, unquote. The command is their only justification for living. It is also their only protection once they're into it. When I came out of the service and went to work for the government, I had a colonel assigned to me as a bodyguard. When he retired, I hired him, he said, pointing to his bodyguard. He's still with me, and that's why we have these. He pointed to the .357 Magnum strapped to his side in plain sight. Who are you worried about, the Russians, the Chinese? Well, I'll tell you. You can damn near put a pin in the map anywhere you want. I got into military security before the Second World War. I was just a kid. Over the years, I was assigned to 32 different countries, so you can draw your own conclusion. But what you've been talking about is a political action, not a military one. How then, as a military security man, did you get involved in political actions? Well, suppose there were countries that were doing technological research on things which could be injurious to the welfare of the United States. I'd be one of the guys assigned to destroy those scientists who were involved in the research. That was with friendly and unfriendly governments. So naturally, if they found out that I was in on it, even now, they'd come after me. In other cases, I was involved in knocking off some dictators. Then we changed the people's voting ideas when they had to elect someone. I return to the main thread of our conversation. Okay, now since we have this mind control technology, what is to keep the guys in the cryptocracy or the military, as you maintain, from programming presidents as soon as they take office or immediately after they get elected? I've always wondered about Nixon, he mused. He was very pro-military. He gave them just about everything they wanted in the world. But he wanted to create a monarchy with himself as king. And slowly but surely, he tried to take over the military and the CIA through subordinate officers who were loyal to him only. All you hear about are left-wing conspiracies to overthrow our government. You never hear about right-wing conspiracies. Next, the patriotic assassin here goes on to say, basically, that the country, the United States, that is, has had a right-wing coup. That is to say, the 18 or 20 people who run the country that he alluded to earlier have, in fact, taken over the whole country. And it's interesting. He basically, he hints rather directly that there has been a right-wing coup in this country. Continuing here with Barrett's account. All you hear about are left-wing conspiracies to overthrow our government. You never hear about right-wing conspiracies. Well, some of these right-wing groups are far more dangerous than the left-wing. The left-wing's mostly kids with dreams. The right-wing is usually retired military. They're hard, they're trained, they've got arms. But if the right-wing took over right now, that would be just a military dictatorship. And the military would find that its best plans were not upset at all. I'm saying if a dictatorship took over. Hell, we've got one right now, but it ain't overt. It's subtle. You mean those 20 men you were talking about, I asked? Yeah. If the people of this country actually knew that, they would say no the next time they were asked to go to Vietnam. We need the people behind us to fight a war, and if they knew the true facts, who's running things, there wouldn't be the following we'd need to defend the country. That fact alone keeps the sham of politics and free elections, unquote, going. If that is the case, then the results would be different? Yes. If people knew they had a dictatorship. Have you ever heard of a factory slowdown, a strike? Well, Russia has run up against the problem, and so have we in supporting the foreign dictators we support. The American people, like most people, have to feel that they have some right, that they're the good guys, unquote. This is the reason we have never lost a war and have never won a peace. You've got to maintain the sham of freedom no matter what. It wouldn't make any difference what party is in charge or whether it was the elected government or what you call the cryptocracy running it. From an operational sense, the government would operate as it presently is. From the point of view of people paying taxes and defending their country well, we found in Latin America that people won't fight if they think they have a dictator who is just as bad as the enemy who is attacking. That's probably why it would be fairly easy to take over the Soviet Union short of nuclear war. The Soviets could probably be convinced by psychological warfare that their government is certainly a lot more evil than ours, and if we went to war with them, we would eventually win. That is, until the H-bomb started to fall, then nobody'd be the winner. Changing the subject, I asked, what area of the military were you in? I don't think I ought to answer that. Let's say there was a group which first sought to solve problems politically. If that didn't work, then there was another group which went in and tried to buy solutions. If that failed, then my group was sent in to be damn sure things were accomplished the way we wanted them to be. So you were operational and not research at all, I asked. No, I had been in the lab for a long time. The knowledge I developed was very valuable in an operational sense. I was put into the field because of this knowledge. You're talking about pretty sophisticated equipment, not commando stuff. Right. For example, I won't say the name of the country, but it was a South American country. We had a leader that we had supported there who suddenly got the idea that he was going to go off on his own. They tried to reason, negotiate, and buy off his affections. When all that failed, my team was sent in to correct the situation. We went in very quietly and left very noisily. We went in as tourists, but the important material we brought in was the turning point. Let's say we couldn't reason with the man anymore. We were there about 6 days and the problem disappeared. Not many bodies, just the important ones. The last section here, the patriotic assassin goes on to describe several specific political actions that he was involved in. Apparently, also a blown assassination attempt against a well-known political figure who, according to Bauert, was later removed by non-lethal means. In other words, he was destroyed politically by some means that didn't kill him. And interestingly enough, Bauert also mentions that he put the tape recording of the patriotic assassin's remarks through a psychological stress evaluator and found the account to be valid in all respects. And the final thing in this interview that I'm reading here is basically some speculation. The book was written very early in the Carter administration, but some speculation that if President Carter continued on the sort of idealistic tack that he appeared to be on at one point, that he would be assassinated. The assassin says that he would definitely be killed. Interestingly enough, though, the assassin also points out that the guy was a career naval man with top security clearance, and he says don't be too surprised if the guy turns out to be in the military's camp. And for a book written in 1978, I think you'd have to say that was pretty prophetic. Last section of the interview with the patriotic assassin reads as follows. The assassin was very specific, telling about some of the jobs he'd accomplished. Several included actions taken against a well-known political figure. That, the assassin said, was the only assassination he'd ever blown, unquote. His rifle malfunctioned at the critical moment when he had his target in the crosshairs of his sight. I cannot say that I had originally believed the assassin's claims, but after running the psychological stress evaluator on all the critical portions of his interview and finding no areas which unexpectedly or inexplicably produced stress, I believed that the assassin was telling the truth. The newspaper office he had mentioned was bombed when he said it was, but he could have gained knowledge of that from newspaper reports. The target of his unsuccessful hit was subsequently taken care of, unquote, in another way which did not cost him his life. The assassin concluded the interview with a chilling prophecy. Jimmy Carter was then a candidate for the presidency. "I'll tell you something right now," the assassin said. "You've got a man running for office that is expressing the same goddamn philosophy John Kennedy had. Now, he could be saying this stuff just to get elected. Matter of fact, if you look into his background, you find that he was a good naval officer. He had top security clearance. He was trained by Admiral Rickover, who, he said, had a strong influence on his life. Taking this into consideration, you can assume that he's a loyal member of the old boy net, so he probably will make a good figurehead president for those in power. But if he ain't an old boy, and if he does believe all those things he's been telling the voters, if he tries to implement those reforms he's talking about, well, it's not a question of whether he's going to be snuffed. It's only a question of when or where." I would add that on May 5th, 1979, Jimmy Carter escaped on a reputedly aborted assassination attempt in which some riflemen supposedly who'd come up from Mexico apparently were represented by a fellow whose name was Ray Lee Harvey. That's Ray as in James Earl Ray and Lee Harvey as in Lee Harvey Oswald. And President Carter was not killed, of course. Interestingly enough, shortly after that, he had the big policy conference at which basically his whole foreign policy swung dramatically to the right. So one can only speculate about just what was really the case with James Earl Carter. Anyway, that one detail I forgot to mention. Now, the two assassins, or would-be assassins, were not. One guy was named Ray Lee Harvey. The other guy was named Oswaldo Ortiz. And I suspect that this is true. You can it happened on May 5th, 1979. You can check the press accounts at the time. I suspect that Jimmy Carter perhaps had not turned out to be the puppet they were hoping he was, and that he was sent a message. That concludes the first part of the lecture this evening, so we're going to take a break. Paul is over here with Paul from Archives on Audio, with various material ranging from tapes, a very important manuscript by Harlan Girard that I'm going to be reading later, and anti-Nazi buttons and all sorts of things that you can avail yourselves of. Okay, if people want to sit down and get themselves ready, gird their loins, so to speak, we're going to proceed. After the tape of the Patriotic Assassin, which, even though at the distance of almost 10 years now, I can hear the difference in my own reading abilities, and I was saying, that really isn't up to snuff. Still, it's as chilling a portrait, I think, of what our society is in the year of our Lord, 1992. And from my own experiences and living here in the Silicon Valley, or as I call it, the Valley of the Shadow of Death, with all of the military and intelligence elements that abound here, I think that that is a very realistic portrayal, an absolutely accurate first-hand account of exactly where we're at the present time, and it's not a pretty picture at all. Now, one of the things that the Patriotic Assassin spoke about, and that I touched on in my introduction, was the use of mind control to create couriers and spies. And mind control can be used to enhance the functioning of couriers and spies in a number of ways, some of which were, again, touched upon by the Patriotic Assassin. For one thing, mind control and hypnosis can be used to create someone who can memorize things that would not otherwise be memorizable, so to speak. You heard the Patriotic Assassin talking about how an individual can be hypnoprogrammed to memorize an entire code book, and in other words, an entire book of information which is coded. One of the experiments cited by Walter Bowert in Operation Mind Control was an early experiment in which an individual who had a reasonably good memory but not a great memory was then placed under hypnosis and read an entire page of a phone book, and then was able, under hypnosis again, to read back the entire page accurately. Entire passages of Shakespeare can be memorized by people with low educations. All of this has been proven experimentally. Obviously, this has applications in terms of espionage. Say, hypothetically, again, an individual was to be sent into a defense plant or an installation or an office in order to obtain information. Even if the person was not able to obtain the documents containing the information, an individual so programmed could read down the page and memorize blueprints or highly technical data and then store them away in his or her memory would then be impervious to torture. The individual could be taken and, as the patriotic assassin indicated, tortured to death without revealing the information. The people running this person would then be able to elicit and record all of the information upon the administration of a preconditioned cue, and the post-hypnotic blocking that would render them torture-proof would then be lifted, and the information desired could be recorded by the intelligence agency or military agency in question. One of the things that has also been used in the context of couriers is something which we touched on in the case of Luis Angel Castillo, namely the actual creation of multiple personalities. In a book called The Control of Candy Jones, put out, actually authored by Donald Bain, last name B-A-I-N, this book came out in 1976 in softcover, copyrighted by the Playboy Press. It documents the use by the Central Intelligence Agency of a woman named Candy Jones. As I mentioned earlier, Candy had been behind Betty Grable, probably the most popular, quote, pinup girl, unquote, for U.S. GIs during World War II. After the war, she was not only put to work for the CIA, but she founded her own modeling agency. Now, Candy had had a lonely childhood, and she had created an imaginary playmate whom she termed Arlene Grant. This is not at all unusual in the fantasy life of youngsters. They will create all kinds of people to play with or characters. A somewhat light example, of course, would be the comic strip Calvin and Hobbes, where you have this imaginary tiger who plays with a little boy, and nobody can see the tiger but the little boy. Candy, in a sense, created a playmate to counteract the loneliness of her childhood. She termed this playmate Arlene Grant, and her fantasy play as a child became developed enough to the point where this fantasy playmate assumed a very large place in her existence. Now, later, when she was put into the CIA's mind control courier program, Arlene Grant was developed into a separate personality, one which would carry out the CIA's tasks, and one which was at times actually hostile, antithetical to the real human being, Candy Jones. One of the things that was brought out when Candy's programming was to a certain extent discovered, she married New York talk show host Long John Neble, who had a very popular late-night talk show in New York City, and Neble eventually discovered that Candy had been hypno-programmed. He observed a new personality emerging from time to time, and this personality was not only different from the Candy Jones that he had known and loved and married, but exhibited actual hostility to and contempt for Candy Jones. Eventually, Neble was able to hypnotically regress Candy Jones back to some of the experiences she had had while working as a CIA courier. And as a result, he was able to deprogram Candy to a certain extent. There is speculation that one of Candy's hypno-programmers for the CIA might have been the very William Jennings Bryan III that I alluded to earlier. This is an individual believed to have been the hypno-programmer, probably of Saran Saran, quite possibly of Arthur Bremer as well. I spoke about him earlier. Interestingly, when he became the focus of the interests of a number of researchers looking into the intelligence community, he died of a heart attack, unfortunately a methodology that is not all that unusual given when there is a national security investigation underway. Now, in the material which I discussed from Commander Narut's or Lieutenant Commander Narut's account of the audio desensitization of passive-aggressive personalities as in order to develop them as assassins, there was an account of how these assassins, once stationed abroad in U.S. embassies, were propagandized and conditioned in such a way as to view the natives of whatever country they were in as inferior, as unworthy of life. They were also taught a contempt for the political processes and the political leadership of the countries into which they were going to be stationed. One of the things that... there are a number of very disturbing things that come out in the book, The Control of Candy Jones, as Long John Nebel hypnotically regresses Candy back into some of her experiences working for CIA as Arlene Grant. Again, a totally separate personality. As far as anyone has been able to determine, Arlene Grant was the only other personality programmed into Candy Jones. Again, a development and a reification of a fantasy playmate she had created in order to help compensate for what had been apparently a very lonely childhood. Recall, Luis Angel Castillo had four separate personalities, each of which functioned in a different way. But one of the most disturbing aspects to Candy Jones' programming is that she also apparently was programmed in such a way as to view people of other races and other ethnic groups as inferior and worthy of extermination and sterilization. This is tragic because, as I mentioned earlier in the lecture, Candy Jones had founded the first, she had been the first, hers, I should say, had been the first major modeling agency to integrate, to allow black models to walk the runways of the various fashion shows. Despite this, Candy was programmed into hating black people and viewing them as inferior. And the implications of what you're going to be hearing, and I'm going to be playing, or we're going to be hearing an excerpt from Radio Free America program number 6, the implications of being able to completely change, to pervert a person's normal, healthy personality and to alter it in such a way as to serve the interests of and carry the beliefs of a totalitarian power. One of the things that I speculate about at the end of this is that Candy's programming really represents a culmination of the in a psychological sense of the importation of Nazi war criminals into the United States at the end of World War II. But the implications of being able to do this, to take a person of very liberal political persuasion, the first person to allow black models to participate in a major modeling agency, and then to teach this person to hate Jews, to hate blacks, to hate Italians, to view them as inferior, to view them as worthy of sterilization, all of which are ominously reminiscent of the Nazi racial theories and extermination programs extant during the reign of Adolf Hitler. Well, it's terrifying. It's worth contemplating in terms of where this could ultimately lead our society. We're going to hear now, we're going to listen to a segment of Radio Free America program number 6. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air duties. And we're going to actually hear about Candy Jones' racist programming, and you will hear Candy as Arlene Grant talking about how she views the various people she was programmed to hate. This is about maybe 28 minutes or so in length, so we will have to pause briefly to change a cassette.
Anyway, this particular session, Nebel has regressed the Arlene personality back to a time when she was in Miami, that Candy had traveled to Miami and then the Arlene personality had taken over. Okay, and so this is being going on in the present, but the event had taken place in the past. John says, "Do you like Candy?" Meaning the person. Arlene, insolently, with almonds. John, "Are you brave, Arlene?" Arlene, "Not brave, just stupid and strong and fast." John, "Isn't Candy strong?" Arlene, "She's strong, but not as fast as me." John, "Did Jensen," again, that's the CIA doctor, "did Jensen ever suggest to you that you commit suicide?" Arlene, "He can't get rid of me that fast. I won't let her or him." John, "Well, if Candy dies, you're dead." Arlene, "Candy doesn't know that." John, "Do you think Candy would ever kill herself?" Arlene, "It's not called killing. It's stopping what is." John, "What does that mean?" Arlene, condescendingly, "It means stopping the progression of a positive action." John, "That doesn't make any sense." Arlene, "It's the stopping of movement." John, "You mean death?" Arlene, "Yes, of course." John, "Would you like to be dead, Arlene?" Arlene, "I am." John, "If you're dead, how can you talk?" Arlene, "Why don't you die and find out?" Nebel and Arlene continued to talk about Candy and her state of mind at the moment. Arlene told him that Candy was in very deep trouble with Jensen, and that Jensen was looking for Candy. "What will Jensen do if he finds Candy?" John asked. "Make her commit suicide?" "No," Arlene replied, "but Candy might kill herself. She might." In another undated hypnotic session, Nebel had an opportunity to ask Candy if she thought Jensen would ever harm her. Candy had regressed, and John was playing the role of her alter ego.
"John, do you ever think your life is in danger?" "Candy, my life is in danger 24 hours a day, and I am exhausted. I just want to lie down and rest." "John, why do you do this if it puts you in danger and exhausts you? Because Jensen tells you to do it? He's not your friend. He's done you a lot of harm." "Candy, he won't kill me." "John, why not?" "Candy, he's not going to do anything unless he can make it look accidental." "John, are you saying that he would kill you if he could make it look like an accident?" "Candy, no, he wouldn't do it yet because it could be traced to him." Nebel was unable to gain any further information during this session, but was successful at a later date in learning more about his wife's supposed last assignment, unquote. As session after session unfolded, more details of Jensen's plan to have Candy commit suicide surfaced. It was to occur in December of 1972. Jensen had booked a first-class seat for her on Pan Am to Nassau, the Bahamas. She would check into the Paradise Beach Hotel, where she'd been a frequent visitor over the years as Candy Jones. But Arlene Grant would meet her there. That was part of Jensen's plan. He told Candy that she would receive a call during her second day on the island. She asked him who would be calling her, but he refused to tell her. "I assume it was to be Jensen himself who would call, and his call would cause Arlene to take over from Candy and guide her to a steep bluff overlooking the sea. Arlene would make the high dive just as she had done when they were children, and it would be over for Candy Jones." "Did you know that Arlene planned to kill you in the Bahamas?" Nebel asked Candy during a hypnotic session in July of 1973. "Yes." "What had you done to make her that angry with you?" "It's all too complicated," Candy replied. "I was told to meet her there." "Where?" "The Bahamas, the Paradise Beach Hotel." "When did this happen?" Nebel asked. "Last November. That's when I was told." Nebel asked Arlene about the incident during a regression that took place in their apartment on an unspecified date. "Candy is just a dragnet around your neck," Arlene told Nebel, "but she needed you. She had all the time in the world to go to Paradise Island in December and take the high dive, but she married you. If Candy killed herself, Arlene, you would be dead too." "Oh no," replied Arlene, "I'd be the one who'd survive." Jensen had persuaded Arlene of that. "What about Candy's marriage to John, Arlene? Have you been deliberately trying to ruin the marriage?" Arlene laughed her bitter, harsh laugh. "What do you mean, tried? I did ruin it," unquote. Candy's marriage to John Nebel on December 31st, 1972, precluded her taking the trip to the Bahamas. But although it was a heartening incident in that it perhaps indicated that with sufficient motivation, Candy was able to counter certain of Jensen's instructions, it did not signal the end of all control Gilbert Jensen had established over her. His presence pulled at her throughout the early years of the marriage, and on many occasions threatened to smash it to pieces, as certainly she herself would have been smashed had she leaped from the bluff in Nassau. So, just as we saw with George de Morangeld, just as we apparently saw with Mr. Castillo from the Kennedy assassination, and just as we have seen in other examples, the sort of stereotyped MK Ultra assassin was supposed to commit suicide afterward, Candy Jones was going to be silenced forever as a result of basically using hypnosis. And it's worth noting that the strong Arlene Grant had assumed such a degree of autonomy as a separate personality that Jensen had convinced her that she would not die with Candy, which is an indication of just what can be done here. And something else that comes to mind, you know, these days there's been a lot of focus on the efforts by the Reagan administration to muzzle federal employees, not only while they're working for the federal government, but also afterward in order to prevent disclosure of any information which the authorities don't want disclosed. It's worth, I think, examining this in light of that. Certainly, getting employees, key employees, to commit suicide under mind control would be an excellent, excellent means of silencing them forever. And who knows, maybe we'll see a lot of State Department employees and a lot of other people committing suicide and otherwise disposing of themselves, committing suicide and silencing themselves if Reagan's efforts are not successful.